Corporate America seems to have a new strategy.
You could call it divide and conquer the market.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bob Moon, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, August 4th.
Coming up, Kraft Foods has decided the question of the ages. Bob, do Cheese Whiz and Oreos go together?
Okay. Mm. Japan's central bankers have a yen for a more favorable exchange rate.
Later, how not to build a nuclear reactor in your apartment. Those stories ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Let's start with what's becoming something of a trend in the way corporate America does business.
Kraft Foods is the latest U.S. company to announce it's splitting into two separate firms. In the past month, oil giant ConocoPhillips, cereal maker Ralcorp, and others have said they've become too big for their own good and that a corporate divorce is going to increase profits. Well, now Kraft has a plan to focus on two different markets. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
Kraft Foods has amassed one of the largest food and beverage empires in the country. Oscar Mayer is Kraft, Kool-Aid is Kraft, Jell-O is Kraft, and Kraft now thinks it can get more value by splitting that company into two. One company will market snacks, like Oreos, Cadbury chocolates, and Trident gum. The other will market the stuff you eat when you're sitting down for a meal, like Miracle Whip, stovetop stuffing, and Kraft cheese. Harry Balzer is a food analyst with NPD Group.
The snack market is a different category than the main meal market. The snack market can be in-home just as much as it can be an away-from-home market, where the grocery business is mostly an in-home business.
And the snack business is more international. A year and a half ago, Kraft bought Cadbury in the UK, giving it access not only to European markets, but to Turkey and Mexico. According to a company statement, the new $32 billion snacks business will make three-quarters of its sales overseas, with a special focus on something called instant consumption channels. That's industry jargon for gas stations, convenience stores, and kiosks. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Merger mania may not be over, though. Shares of Japanese companies Hitachi and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries surged today after reports surfaced that the two companies were planning to merge. Even though they've both publicly shrugged off a possible deal, the merger would be Japan's biggest ever, and the two would create one of the world's largest companies. Marketplace's Asia Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Japanese companies like Toyota, Honda, Sony, Panasonic, they've become household brands throughout the world. But when's the last time you bought something from Hitachi or Mitsubishi Heavy Industries?
They care more about the domestic market than overseas.
That's Deutsche Security's Takeo Miyamoto. These two companies have helped build Japan's transmission grid, railways, and its nuclear power plants. Now, with Japan's economy on the skids, Miyamoto says these two giant companies will need to start looking outside Japan for profits.
Better to merge and become larger so that they will have enough resources to compete against the large competitors in the global market.
That global market used to be packed with the likes of GE, Bechtel, Fluor, big American firms. But more low-cost Chinese engineering firms will now make it more difficult for a super company like this to thrive. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
Well, another big Japanese name is making news today, Sony. That company's heading for its eighth straight year of losses in the TV-making business. But today it ruled out dumping its television division. Sony says TV remains a core business, and at the same time it conceded its next-generation PlayStation will not be ready for sale here in the United States, or in Europe for that matter, in time for Christmas. Now that's a crucial sales period for game console makers.
One of the big challenges for Sony lately has been weak demand in the U.S. and other markets it counts on. Today, Japan's central bank decided to do something about that. It intervened to slow the rise of the yen against the dollar. That'll help Japanese companies sell things abroad. For more on this, we reached Ken Curtis on the line from Singapore. He's a former Goldman Sachs exec and now heads Themes Investment Management in Asia. Good day, sir. And why did Japan decide to respond like this?
Japan is in a real conundrum. Its domestic economy is weakening. Consumer spending is extremely fragile. The little growth it's been getting these last few years has been through exports to America, to Europe and China, and they're all slowing. And in this increasingly complex global risk environment, I think the Japanese just felt that this was too strong a currency, and if it remained that strong, it could push their economy back into a recession and a deep one.
Well, all those symptoms you mentioned sound pretty familiar over here on this side of the Pacific. Are we going to see more steps like this from central banks to stimulate economies around the globe?
Given that we've run out of fiscal room, that is the ability of governments to spend in most developed economies, we're going to see more and more pressure on central banks to intervene to try to support these weakening economies.
What about here in the U.S.? Does the Federal Reserve have any more tools left in its toolbox?
Well, it's got the one tool that it could use, and that's to just try to pump more money in the economy. The problem in the U.S. is that the banks have extremely fragile balance sheets because they're still carrying all this bad debt from the residential real estate crash, and home prices are going down still in the U.S., so that's creating more problems for the U.S. banks. So when the Fed pumps more money into the economy because the banks are so afraid and fragile, instead of lending the money, they're just hoarding it, just afraid that if there is a new downturn in the economy, they've got a whole new round of bad debt and bankruptcies to deal with.
Investment manager Ken Curtis in Asia, thanks for your insights.
You're welcome.
Today, the European Central Bank and the Bank of England kept interest rates steady. That's amid the stubborn debt crisis that's causing the European economy to sputter. Reporter Christopher Worth is with us now from London with the latest on that and how different central banks can perhaps stimulate the economy. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
So central banks stepping in, what can they do to help the economy?
Well, you know, central banks set monetary policy, right? You know, they raise or lower interest rates. They're tasked with keeping inflation low. And in some cases, they try to keep the economy moving along. And that's what the Bank of England and the European Central Bank are dealing with. There's even talk they might start buying up bonds again. And that's the central banks saying, right, we're not seeing the economic growth we need. So we'll try to give the economy a kickstart by keeping borrowing costs low. And we've sort of seen a wave of central bank activism over the last few days. Switzerland and Japan have seen their currencies rise as a result of these economic worries. So Switzerland's central bank has slashed interest rates. And Japan's central bank, it's also trying to devalue its currency right now.
Can it work, Chris?
Well, there's a danger to all this, Steve. Here's Karsten Brzeski. He's an economist at ING in Brussels.
If you really kind of turn the faucet, the taps open, the big risk is inflation. And the second risk is actually that it doesn't help.
He says you have to think of these central banks like fire brigades here. You know, they can put out fires, but they can't do important things like reform labor markets or balance deficits.
Any hopes that the Federal Reserve, our central bank here in the U.S., will roll out the fire trucks, Chris?
Well, interest rates are already at rock bottom. Brzeski says there's a big push among investors for Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke to begin a third round of the Fed pumping money into banks to buy up bonds. But again, he says it will have a limited effect.
Reporter Christopher Worth in London. Chris, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Federal authorities are trying to get to the bottom of the deaths of at least six golden eagles in Southern California, and the focus is on a major wind farm project operated by the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Wind energy advocates worry the deaths could lead to prosecution, or at the very least, really bad publicity.
In France, a massive wind farm is facing opposition of a different sort, Bob. The project is planned for the coast of Normandy, visited every year, as we all know, by thousands of World War II veterans and their families. Mm-hmm. The BBC's Christian Fraser reports from Paris.
President Sarkozy earlier this year announced plans to create 6,000 megawatts of new offshore wind energy by 2020, enough electricity to supply more than 3.5 million homes. What he failed to mention at the time was that some of these giant wind turbines would be sunk into the sea off the D-Day beaches of Normandy. Opponents have started an online petition to stop it. Jean-Louis Boutre from the Federation for a Sustainable Environment says the decision is sacrilegious.
I got a phone call from England from a group, Royal Air Force group captain. He was very upset and he said, you know, if they build those turbines, I will come back and bomb those turbines.
Siting the windmills will be a challenge in itself. The approaching seabed is littered with unexploded munitions. In Paris, I'm the BBC's Christian Fraser for Marketplace.
From wind energy to a nuclear chain reaction of sorts, Bob, a Swedish man has been arrested for trying to split atoms in his kitchen. We all try and split atoms in the kitchen, don't we? We're cutting tomatoes and we're trying to split atoms. The man, his name is Richard Handel, was trying to create a nuclear reactor there as a hobby. in his apartment.
Sounds perfectly plausible
perfectly.
To
this
me.
Is what most people do, right, in their spare time. The 31-year-old kept a blog of his experiment with elements of radium and uranium and americium.
Okay.
Because everyone has those lying around.
Uh-huh. The man, right there next to the paprika, right?
There, that's right, and the thyme. The man wondered if his nuclear curiosity violated any laws. And so he zipped off a letter to Sweden's radiation authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know how they responded?
Mm.
They sent in the police.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, August 4th. I'm Bob Moon in for Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. We got an intriguing glimpse this morning of a slightly improved unemployment picture. Jobless claims, what do you know, dipped last week to 400,000. Now, that's the lowest level in 4 months. And in the face of all the recent headwinds, General Motors was able to double its quarterly profit to $2.5 billion. Now, you can credit the good price that GM is finally getting for its cars and trucks.
Let's look deeper at those unemployment numbers with Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, on the line with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Isn't that 400,000 level kind of the tipping point? More jobless claims than that is bad, below that generally good?
Absolutely. The good news is we're now moved back to the 400,000 level. That is a level that's more consistent with 100 to 150,000 in terms of job growth, which would be up significantly from the virtual zero we saw in June. We're not going to see that in July's numbers, but as we move through the summer, we'll begin to see it. That's the good news. Of course, the bad news is it's still basically treading water. That's not enough to take down the unemployment rate. So even as we get back to those kinds of payroll levels, it will still be a very tough labor market, and the continuing claims, which is sort of a misery index out there, continue to rise.
But the market is indicating it's still worried. How does this jibe with the notion that the economy might be slowing down?
Well, I think the issue is the economy has slowed down. Revisions to GDP really underscore that. And what we're seeing out there is that our ability to keep the economy going through stimulus measures, whether it be fiscal or monetary stimulus, are starting to run out. You saw the Bank of Japan trying to do more measures today, Switzerland trying to do, central bank trying to do more measures today, and many people are looking to the Fed to carry the burden of stimulating the economy further. But frankly, the bullets in our arsenal for fighting the slowdown down in growth are starting to run out.
Very quickly, though, does that signal that central banks are back in the financial driver's seat?
They certainly are back in the financial driver's seat. I'm not sure they ever left, although they weren't as visible for quite a while. And that is a difficult situation for them because they don't have as many options as they once did open to them. In fact, the European Central Bank has said, basically, we're not going to try to do much today.
Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial, thanks.
Thank you.
The annual hacker convention known as Black Hat is now in full swing in Las Vegas. Every year, thousands of hackers and security professionals descend on the desert Mecca to show off their latest exploits. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, one researcher plans to give a talk today outlining how easy it would be to hack high-frequency trading operations on Wall Street.
High-frequency traders buy stocks low on one market and sell them for a fraction of a penny more on another.
The speed that we're talking about is insanely fast. You know, you think about fast things in your world, and you start thinking about things like blinking your eyes.
James Arlen at Push the Stack Consulting says these trades are 10 times faster than that. Computers make all the transactions. Microseconds are the difference between making a profit and getting hosed. So in the last few years, traders have put their servers in the same secret building with the New York Stock Exchange computers, and they've invested big time in building the fastest computers possible. What that means is they've stripped their trading software and hardware down to the bare bones. If these computers were cars, there would be no seatbelts, no roll bars, minimal security. Hacking made easy.
Easy peasy.
And Arlen's convinced someone, somewhere, who has access to these networks is going to try. In Las Vegas, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, Bob, the Gap is trying to fill a big gap in its sales.
Mm.
So for fall, the clothing retailer is rolling out a host of new denim designs, and it's folded shirts and folding tacos, as a matter of fact. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
A recent Gap ad features supermodel Anya Rubik strutting her stonewashed stuff. She usually walks the runway for high-end fashion houses like Gucci. But Gap's also trying a lowbrow approach. Taco trucks, branded Pico de Gap, will roll out in New York, L.A., and other cities to plug the new jeans. Retail analyst Patty Edwards.
That is a brilliant move.
The trucks will sell $1.69 tacos with a Gap coupon in the wrapper. The taco's free if you just shopped at Gap. Sounds cheapo and cheesy, but Edwards says it could convince customers that Gap is gritty, urban, and hip.
If you watch Food Network, which I watch way too much of it, food truck races are a huge thing. The whole concept is cutting edge, it's new, it's different.
Edwards says Gap needs to do something. It hasn't had a fashion hit since khakis a decade ago. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
What some companies won't cook up to promote their brand. Which brings us to Jonathan Kapolsky. He's just written a new book titled Brand Resilience, taking a look at how much the lightning-fast internet and the 24-hour news cycle has affected the concept of branding. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, delighted to be here, Bob. Thank you.
You know, making my way through your book, for some reason, the old Ajax Stronger Than Dirt commercial was going through my head. And I wonder, we've come a long way from those days, television commercials with jingles. How is branding different today in this age of Twitter and Facebook and all that?
In today's world, consumers control your brand versus the world that you were talking about in which we all control the brands that we owned.
But you've now got the possibility that one angry customer can write a song, put it on YouTube, and have it go viral. So how do you deal with that kind of thing?
Well, one of the things that we've seen, you're referring to one of the airlines which had a song written about a passenger whose guitar was damaged, tried to get benefits back from the airline. The airline was unable to provide him with the appropriate recompense, wrote a song, filmed it, put it on YouTube, and the next thing you knew, there were 9 million hits for that individual song.
And as a brand, how do you deal with that?
So, I mean, number one is acknowledging sometimes that you've made a mistake. Number two is offering recompense to the people. Number three is taking the steps so that the things that caused the incident, the brand damaging incident or the brand sabotage to happen, can't happen again.
We talk about something going viral. Is it just as easy to respond to something going viral because your message can get out there a lot faster than it used to be?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of chance to build alliances and build allies among the people who are out there. So starting to build those, that ecosystem, if you will, of individuals who can be helpful to you, get the word out, and start to be your advocates is as important as the people who could be your would-be saboteurs.
Jonathan Kapolsky's book is Brand Resilience, Managing Risk and Recovery in a High-Speed World. Good luck marketing your book, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.
Speaking of promoting your brand, Steve, let me tell you right up front, I pulled this off the PR Newswire.
Oh, yeah.
As in, this is a publicity gimmick.
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious. The folks at M&M Mars are celebrating the first birthday of their M&M pretzel candies. I guess they're trying to drive home the point that they've been a smashing success.
Okay.
So they've created a huge M&M-shaped pinata.
Oh, smashing, yes.
The world's biggest ever, they claim. And they're breaking it open in New York today. It's filled with 2,000 pounds of bags of guess which kind of candy.
I guess, yeah, I think we know what kind of candy is going to be in that thing. I guess you don't have to worry about finding this pinata with a blindfold on.
A little hard to miss. It's 46 feet tall and 68 feet wide.
Oh, my gosh, that's a lot of candy. Jeez.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. I think we can see that pinata all the way from here to the East Coast. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.